welcome to Base Camp for Men. I'm your host, Tony Rezac. This is the show that gives you insights and resources on how to live a more courageous life. We'll be looking at men, the current state of masculinity, and how to create a more inspiring narrative for all men. Welcome, and let's get started. Hello, Base Campers. I hope you're all doing well. You know, of all the issues that the world faces, there is perhaps no greater indicator of enemy and intent than the war on children and on innocence itself. And it's interesting to note that citizen journalists have reported over 300,000 missing children from our border. Think about that for a second. From the mainstream media, it's been fucking crickets. No surprise there, as they've been running cover for this and a bunch of other crap for decades, haven't they? 300,000 missing little ones, and the globalists have nothing to share with we the people. Why not? Well, the CIA Mockingbird Media work for our adversary, and they exist to keep you in the dark. You know this already. Do you think this number is exaggerated? By how much? Can you see the flawed logic here? Oh, there isn't 300,000. It's only been 100,000 or 80,000 or 50,000. Are you following me? Which is the acceptable number of missing children at our wide open southern border? Is there a number that is acceptable? To what ends? In addition to gagging on this big red pill is something even more insidious and clever, and it is the war on innocence itself. This is directly impacting a whole generation or generation and a half of children. Kids are just not left alone anymore. Do you notice that? There seems to be no time in government indoctrination camps known as public schools for innocent and imaginative play. Kids are hollered at to hurry up at lunch where they're given 20 minutes total, which really amounts to 10 minutes with their friends. I've witnessed this firsthand at public schools. The kids are not honored, not on a soul level. Everything is about obedience and compliance. And the kids are not thriving. That much is crystal clear to everyone. I had coffee with a friend the other day, and he talked about how great some of the public schools were when we were kids, and they were. There was a respect for country and a true desire to equip young people with math and reading and civics and even some critical thinking skills. All that has been pushed aside for Marxist ideology, Paulo Freire, and their woke social justice nonsense. Every kid needs to be force-fed transgenderism, you know, in case they're confused. Kids are being dumbed down. I can't say that any clearer than that. This conflict has parents on one side and the Marxist communists on the other. Ask yourself this, Base Camper, which side is fighting for kids and their innocence? And which side is fighting for more state-controlled indoctrination with its mandatory obedience and compliance? Why do communist and Marxist educators want to produce dumbed-down kids who only spout their agenda and ideas? Is there an agenda to produce a dumbed-down population? To quote author and thought leader Jimmy Song, quote, universities are useful idiot factories, unquote. Not to mention the public schools. I remember reading the author and three-time New York Teacher of the Year, John Taylor Gatto, when he said that homeschool kids will end up being way smarter and better off than your average public school kids. I wasn't 100% sure what he meant 20 years ago, but boy, I can sure see it now. People are leaving public schools in droves. It's a dying institution as more and more parents are realizing that keeping them away from Marxists who don't like humanity is actually a way better option than subjecting their little ones to any more of this. Let's renew our sense of innocence, both in ourselves and in the imaginative play of our kids. For it is my belief that humans of all age can carry a childlike curiosity and joy for life without sacrificing street smarts. The communist globalists are counting on us abandoning this superpower. We will not. It only takes a small band of parents and kids to say that we will live with our innocence and divinity intact, despite the attacks on us, to win, and win we shall. Today's interview is part two with the excellent Simon Essler. Enjoy our conversation. Today's episode is brought to you by Stand Up Now Apparel. Stand Up Now has amazing designs centered on God, family, freedom, and patriotism. They use only the softest cotton in their designs and have gear for the whole family. There's something for everyone, Base Campers. I know you're going to love their products. Go support them at www.standupnowapparel.com and use the code BASECAMP to receive a 10% discount and free shipping. And now, on to our interview. My guest today is Simon Essler. Simon is a committed defender of families and the lost art of free thought. He has been an actor, an ordained minister, and mindfulness entrepreneur, which has led him to become a professional content creator and independent filmmaker. His website, www.simonessler.com, hosts an array of films, series, and resources focused on leveraging the pressures of modern war to foster personal growth and collective resilience. Here is my interview with Simon Essler. You know, you had mentioned that you'd wrote about child sacrifice, which is you had an article in your Substack, Child Sacrifice, since we're on the topic of children, child sacrifice as a pillar of deep state control. And, you know, some would say, I think that's this is the heart of the matter. It's the heart of the war, really. And some people, it's too much. I understand people going, oh my God, why are they talking about that? Why is he mentioning that? That's so, you know, but I think 10 years ago, had you written that or you and I were speaking about it, people would have been going, what in the hell are these guys talking about? Why, you know, what medication are they on? But suddenly, with the arrest of P. Diddy and the Epstein Island list and all of the evidence, all the weird advertising that you see in media, on social media, all the weird imagery, satanic, Luciferian, all the weird blood, color red all over the place. Suddenly people, I think, are starting to figure out something is going on with the elites, and they're pushing it out into us and our kids. But there's a lot of people in the mainstream, I think, they're in denial because it's a tough rabbit hole. I've been down that rabbit hole and I'm like, oh my God, I cannot believe what is happening. I cannot believe, I would not have 15, 20 years ago, I know you said you're conspiratorial even back then. You know, I was down 9/11 conspiracy theories and that there was a deep state that was a shadow government pulling all these strings and that the CIA was perhaps our biggest enemy or a tool of the enemy. But if you would have shown me some of the child ritual sacrifice and the kidnapping of children and the sexual abuse and rape of children, I would have said, Simon, there's no way. I think you're going too far. I don't know if there's evidence. I think we're both paranoid. But now I can say it pretty matter-of-factly, and I think the matter-of-fact conversation is having a lot of people wake up. You know, what are your thoughts on that? Where is it coming from? Why are they doing? Is it just to dehumanize humans? Is it you know, a tool the enemy likes to use to make it seem like, you know, we're in control and you're not? Is it some weird ancient, you know, I've even been down rabbit holes where it looks like an ancient religion that has come over there, you know? And so there's a lot of pattern recognition when you start down that rabbit hole, I think, especially if you're a veteran like yourself. You can kind of jump in anywhere there. I touched on like five or six different things for you.
Like, I think I am interested in these really sort of shocking taboo subjects. They intrigue me a lot. You know, the idea that elite pedophilia and child sacrifice, you know, and satanic pedophilia, the fact that all of these things seem to be thought crimes mm-hmm. has really deeply fascinated me. It's very strange when you start to look at the behavior of media and, you know, high level sort of elite figures around those topics. They start to behave very squeamishly in a really, really strange way.
Yep.
I think there's some basic ways you can invite even the most mainstream minded people into this. Mm-hmm. One is that our world has become increasingly anti-child.
Yep.
Okay. In very, very basic ways, we become anti-child. So there is more in the world that is out in the open to traumatize children. So we've accepted more and more adult content in public spaces. Okay, so, you know, a good example of this is Pride. You know, when Pride season comes around, there's a genuine struggle for us with adult sexuality spilling into public spaces. We have a number of instances with our own children where their innocence is threatened because there is a normalization of adult you know, adult content and adult events within public spaces. Now, that's a pattern of ignoring childhood innocence as a reality of life on Earth. Mm-hmm. And one of the other basic ways you can look at the research of someone named Peter Gray. Peter Gray has researched the fact that play, free play for children, has been on an exponential decline for the past 50, 60 years. And so he went back and studied how much free play children used to have, just time when it was just the children by themselves, no adults playing. And he tracks how this has just almost completely disappeared in the lives of children in the West today. So there are basic non-conspiratorial ways that you can see that there has been a change in our culture that rejects innocence.
That just breaks that breaks my heart to hear that, Simon, because I my childhood was steeped in play, and you as a theater person, you know, my wife's was a theater major as well, steeped in imaginative play at all ages. I loved play. I still love play, to be honest with you, and that children are being denied that, or it's being educated out of them by institutions. It's just heartbreaking. It's like it to me, it really shows what we've lost in this war, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Because we're not, you know, there's a certain amount of this that has to do with just the awareness of the human collective and its maturity. And there are just huge areas where we lack awareness and maturity, and we're being beckoned to grow up in this way, to pay attention. You know, there were changes that were incremental in nature, and they were incremental in a way that we really didn't perceive what was being taken away or what was breaking down. And again, because we don't have that legacy keeper's mindset, because we don't think generations into the future like our enemy does, which, you know, we can get to later.
Yep.
But because we don't have that mindset, then we don't perceive, hey, if we let this concept of innocence degrade here, 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 and here, what's that going to look like in three generations? We aren't thinking that way. And so this is a weakness. And when it comes to the kind of war that we're in now, this fifth generation war, that is a cognitive battlefield that literally preys on human awareness. You know, we live in this cognitive battle space that the enemy seeks to get ahead of human awareness. The enemy is looking to get a jump on human awareness, to insert things into the spaces where we lack awareness. This is an important quality of the war that we're in. The degradation of the concept of innocence is a big part of this. And so the way that I understand it is that as our notion of innocence has degraded, it has become easier and easier to normalize things like child abuse. And it started to create spaces where radical people on the left can say, you know, the pedophile is actually the victim of oppression, and they need to be called minor attracted persons so that they're not so oppressed. You know, a space has been cultivated for those ideas to be taken more and more seriously. And I think when I write about child sacrifice, I'm not just speaking about, you know, a bunch of people in robes, you know, throwing a baby into a fire, even though like there's those ideas that some of that is going on. But really what we need to be more aware of is the sacrifice of a child's innocence. This is what is more prevalent today. This is what's happening on a much broader scale. And if we don't have a clear concept of what childhood innocence means culturally as an ideal, then how could we ever defend it? And, you know, I've gone into the rabbit holes of academia and how some of this far left academia is dealing with the concept of innocence. And there are academics out there, prominent academics, that are saying, and this will be very familiar language to people, that there is a child adult binary that needs to be deconstructed, that this is a dangerous binary, and that the concept of childhood innocence is something that is politically constructed by the right to create moral outrage and panic while being able to control children instead of allowing them to be sovereign political beings. This is some of the rhetoric coming from that space. You know, the idea that childhood innocence is a concept created by Disney propaganda and that it has no basis in reality and that it oppresses children. And the idea that we should throw out the concept of childhood innocence because it's a political weapon and it's oppressive and free the children is already in academia as our society is being structured to give pedophiles more freedom to be who they are. And so, you know, the collision is very obvious to me, but people do need to be shown all these moving parts that are often occurring in areas of our society that are not hyper-politicized. And when we live within political trenches, we don't understand the kind of blind spots that we develop when we are daily in the political trenches, when we are thinking, I'm a conservative, I'm a liberal, I'm a liberal, damn those leftists, damn those rightists.
Yeah,
those kinds of political entrenched identities leave massive blind spots in terms of what's shifting in our culture that we need to be paying attention to. And I think that's one of the ways increasingly, as the political division has been ramped up with social engineering, our blind spots have grown in many ways. And so, this is part of the maturity we need to exercise.
Well, and they're going to add to LGBTQ plus the P's, they're ready to put it in there. And I mean, they're trying to prey on people's tolerance of lifestyles. I get that, right? I don't have an issue with people that are gay. I don't have an issue with adults that want to change gender or cross dress, any of that stuff. I don't really care. But I have a problem with them stealing childhood innocence or confusing children and pretending that it's some grand journey to change genders. And I, along with a lot of other people, if they try to stick P on there and say, we must protect pedophiles, these people that prey on children sexually, we have to stand with them. Man, oh man. That's a hard line in the sand. I already had an issue. What? Go ahead.
I don't think that's how it's going to be presented, though. No? I think this is the twist that they're going to give it. Mm. There's going to be the presentation of data.
Yeah.
And this is my theory, but this is going to be the presentation of data showing that right-wing, far-right moral panic about pedophiles has created more child abuse by not giving a space for pedophiles to get treatment and help.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. There's going to be the angle that the anti-pedophile movement is itself creating more child abuse. I can see the headline in The Atlantic already. It's so obvious to me the way they're going to spin that and say that actually, see, they've already built up the argument when you go through what materials already exist. They've already built up the argument of the virtuous pedophile, that you have the offending and the non-offending pedophile. And what's happening is everyone's so outraged about pedophilia, they don't realize that there's all these virtuous pedophiles, people that just dream of having sex with children but never act on it, and they need to be supported, and they're not criminals. It's not, is a thought crime to have all these things. And they're going to push for the idea that pedophilia is an inborn sexual orientation, just like they built the narrative about homosexuality being, a brain-based thing that people can't help and they're born with, that sort of the foundational basis for the civil rights of homosexuality. They're going to look to mimic that with pedophilia, say that it's an orientation, therefore certain civil rights are needed. And with that argument built, there's going to be this idea that the panic, the right-wing panic, is actually causing more child abuse. It's going to be something along those lines.
Yeah.
And already, there's a scientist here in Toronto, with CBC created a documentary, basically a propaganda piece uplifting his work. And he claims to have found the physical genetic markers of the pedophile, that pedophiles are, more left-handed and that they have certain brain features. This is already being constructed right now. I just see the way they're going to trot it out personally.
That's an interesting point. Did you, not to muddy the waters even more, but I remember about 20 years ago, maybe, did you ever see The Woodsman with Kevin Bacon? It was a film about a pedophile.
I don't think so.
It's a really brilliant film, but it was the first shot across the bow, but basically Kevin Bacon's character, he had an early childhood sexual memory of his sister sitting on his lap and he was smelling her hair and it was getting him off, right? And he carried that into adulthood. In other words, he was a minor attracted adult the film showed Kevin Bacon as a sympathetic character. In other words, he never did rape or force himself sexually on a child. What he liked was to have a girl sit on his lap and he would sniff her hair, right? That was the extent of his kink. And back then, I was like, oh man, that just complicates things vastly. Like, do I think if the Kevin Bacon character doesn't do anything else with children and that's his kink, is he harming a lot of people? The answer in my mind back then, I was like, no, I don't really think so. I don't think he should be treated the same as a pedophile that kidnaps kids, holds them, rapes them, repeatedly kills them, all the different things that a violent pedophile can do. I don't think the two are the same person. I don't think it's the same, right? And I remember saying that to some of my friends and they're like, dude, you're on a slippery slope. And back then I was like, no, I see what the filmmaker's saying about this. Now I see it as like a first shot across the bow. Is there pedophiles that don't actually harm children? Yes. How do you identify them though? Is there pedophiles that absolutely are a danger to all children? Absolutely. What's the breakdown of that? I don't know. Yeah, it's a complicated topic, but
yeah, more complicated than people want to admit because there's some big, big questions that come along with this. So number one, the idea that our sexual orientation is immutable, I think there needs to be some more flexible thinking about this. I have a lot of big questions, right? The idea that people are born with their sexual orientation already kind of dismisses the idea that we can be groomed in the direction of anything sexual at all. But if that's the case, if we really cannot be groomed into different sexual orientations, then are we to believe that the massive influence of pornography and the pornography industry and how that has become more and more debaucherous and degraded morally, we're going to believe that that hasn't influenced the sexual behavior of billions of people in a specific direction? Why? Because there's this idea that you're born with your sexual orientation and it's fixed. I don't see how we can play out something like a massive porn industry where the top searched term for men is teen, and men in the millions and billions are consuming constant hours and hours of footage of what they're being told is like potentially underage girls. How is it possible that there is influences that powerful that aren't changing the sexual preferences of people on Earth? I just don't buy that. Now that brings the flip side of it around, which is, can someone who has a disturbing orientation towards children be supported and groomed in the other direction? Could they be groomed using, let's say, heterosexual porn and brought into a place where they have that attraction? Now, there is research actually that has looked into that. There's a researcher who recently died, unfortunately, but his name is Paul Fedoroff. And, you know, he's a researcher in Ottawa who was seeking to heal pedophiles in this way. He actually helped them shift towards a more healthy sexual orientation where they were attracted to people their age. And from the data, he was actually really successful at doing this. But this brings us to a very difficult issue because a lot of people who have been very passionate about the pedophilia issue, a lot of people on that side of things are firm that a pedophile can never, ever be healed, that there is no reason to ever believe that they can be changed, and that they are a permanent danger to society. Now, if that's true, we have a big issue because we have millions and millions and millions of men that are pedophiles today. That's a huge number. So what are we going to say? That we have to arrest this giant portion of the male population and put them in prison because they have what we're claiming is an unchangeable orientation towards children? I don't know. We're in a very tricky situation, but I think we have to acknowledge that the culture in which we live can impact sexual orientation, but that's going to challenge a lot of people on every side of the political aisle.
All part of the fifth generation warfare, which is something I wanted. So, you know, I think I got it from some of your writing that you had also read Michael Flynn and Boone Cutler's Citizen's Guide to Fifth Generation Warfare. Yeah, so I've got both sessions. Session one was Introduction to 5GW, Fifth Generation Warfare, and the second session was How to Fight Artificial Intelligence. So a pro-humanity stance on both. Everything we've touched on, from education to pedophilia, is part of this narrative of fifth generation warfare. You know, back in World War II days, it was pretty easy to, for if you asked anybody, are we at war? The answer was yes, because there was artillery, there was troops, there was, you know, it was, we're at war, we're not at war. It was very easy to tell. But with technological advancements, just everything from AI, the CIA, man, oh man, do they do a psyop job on people to keep them in the dark? You know, it has become a narrative war and a thought war. Who controls the thought space? Who controls beliefs? You're seeing psyops from both sides, from both the black hat, you know, globalist communist side, as well as the white hat pro-humanity side. Both sides are using technology. Both sides are using encryption. Both sides are using narrative news stories that go out either on the mainstream media or in side channels like Telegram, or somebody like Tucker Carlson, who's now over on X. So there seems to be this push and pull of who's going to control the planet and humanity for generations. And yet the odd thing is, Simon, you could talk to, you know, 20 people. I could go down the street and ask people, you know, are we at war right now? Are you aware of something called fifth generational warfare, narrative and information warfare? Most would probably say, I don't know what that is. I don't know. We're not at war. Yeah, things are shitty here in Seattle. We've got a massive problem with, you know, homelessness and mental health and addiction. And the city looks like shit. It's really dirty. But other than that, you know, they might hate Trump or hate Kamala, whatever their orientation is. But a lot of people would be in the dark, and that's a little shocking for me, somebody that's been swimming in these waters for many, many, many years. You know, I guess I wanted to give you a chance to address like the importance of waking people up to the fact that we're in a conflict and you're being played and there's psyops coming at you all over the place. Are you aware of that? Both sides are using them. Are you aware of that? And I guess just give you a chance to talk about what you're noticing, what resources maybe do you use to stay up to date? I'm finding myself there's a balance of being on the pulse and having way too much input where I'm just like, yeah, I know. I've seen that, you know, 50 fucking times at this point. Right. I need to have bandwidth so I can breathe, do meditation, you know, just exercise, have meals with my family. Like I have to be able to, inside of this war, be able to function as a man. So, yeah, anything in there is free game.
I think there are some people that are designed to sort of perpetually chase the narrative.
Yeah.
And they're good at it.
Yeah.
But I think most people are not. And a lot of people feel a pressure to have an opinion right away,
mm-hmm.
when they should stop and say nothing and wait.
Yeah.
I think that's a lot of people. Or don't share an opinion. Don't go straight to trying to form an opinion. There is a problem with certainty. There is an absolute plague of certainty. It is an issue on the fifth generation battlefield that people have way too much certainty. And to me, you know, this is interesting because I've looked at it from the lens of the brain and the Western brain. And that seems to be characteristic of the Western brain, that we are entrenched in the West, in the left hemisphere of the brain, which is the part of the brain that really deals with certainty, with constructing things into very linear narratives, in having things very composed of logical parts and looking at things from this reductionist, mechanistic view. You know, that is our left hemisphere. It is our right hemisphere that is able to see the world through metaphor, That is able to use doubt and uncertainty, that gives us the capacity to hold multiple contradictory narratives, to cognize multiple different possible truths, you know, to withhold certainty and to rest comfortably in the space of doubt. So it's important to understand to me that the cognitive battlefield that we're in here in the West is wrapped up in the neurology of the normal Western person. And that's important to notice because it unites us. Left wing, right wing, doesn't matter. You have a Western brain, then you're entrenched in the left hemisphere to a certain extent. And so you're going to want certainty. You're going to want stories that feel very clear to you, that lock in what's going on, that make you feel like you understand what's going on. There is an addiction to that in the West that's sort of in, it's built in already. It's already there. It's just a natural product of the Industrial Revolution. To me, it's a natural part of just how we've evolved, how human awareness has evolved. And so that's the part of it that I see that is not warfare. And I think it's important to distinguish that which is intentional fifth generation warfare and that which is just the arc of human evolution and human awareness and human growth and development. And those two things collide in a very interesting way. So, you know, I think that's a good starting point for people, that you almost certainly could use the practice of less, you know, less certainty. There's an importance in exercising doubt, in learning how to hold multiple narratives, multiple truths. These are very basic things that we could be doing, you know, holding the news cycle much more lightly and the politicized identity much more lightly. I recently interviewed Boone Cutler for an upcoming documentary project that I'm working on. And he pointed out something very, very interesting. He said that a lot of the operations that are being waged against us here in North America would never work in India, because in India, fifth generation warfare is openly talked about. The people know about it. It's part of their education and culture. This is normal for the people of India. So there's a whole swath of operations that just won't work there because fifth generation warfare is out in the open. The public has awareness. Now that goes back to what I was.
I did not know
that. Incredible.
Yeah, it is incredible.
It kind of blew my mind. So, you know, and this goes back to what I was saying, is that fifth generation warfare, it preys on the spaces where there's a lack of human awareness. Okay. It's trying to get ahead of human awareness. And so the more we expand our awareness into this cognitive battle space and inform the cognitive battle space ourselves, the less we are available to specific attacks. And that's sort of the way that I like to conceptualize, you know, what's going on. My part of my mission is to help cultivate situational awareness. Now, in the old form of warfare, situational awareness was, you know, the soldier dropping into the jungle and being hyper aware of where his enemies are and being ready in this kind of animalistic way to engage. And now situational awareness has evolved because warfare has evolved, because weaponry has evolved. We're being called into a new form of situational awareness. And the line between citizen and soldier dissolved long ago because the cognition of citizens became territory to capture. It became something that could be weaponized. You know, it became a lot of things to a lot of different people that we would consider our enemies. And so because there was that transformation, the citizen and the soldier are very blurred. And now if you just are alive in the world today, you need a certain amount of situational awareness to understand the nature of what is unfolding around you. So I think that's sort of where we're at today. And one of the clearest ways to understand this is that there are centralized powers in the world. And because of their centralized position, they are able to manage and micromanage human cognition in very, very specific targeted ways. And so when we look at the fact that there is a media conglomerate that functions both in Canada and the US, there's these media conglomerates that seek to control thinking and control human cognition, then you know that's a really good example. You can look at entities like the World Economic Forum and the United Nations, who are these massive centralized supranational powers who are able to insert their agendas into nation states and circumvent democratic consent within nations. Mm-hmm. These are two very clear examples of centralized powers that are able to manage and influence human cognition. And I think that people's awareness being cast upon that more and more will naturally lead to people resisting that.
I'm seeing like this groundswell of decentralized systems, but it seems to be moving at a snail's pace. Like, I don't know. I'm looking at it going, are we building it fast enough? A lot of the systems like Bitcoin's super sturdy, by the way. It's an alternate to a centrally controlled corrupt money. You have decentralized internet protocols like Nostr. And so there's things that are being built. Even decentralized medicine is starting to pop its head up. And so I see one of the things I'm optimistic about is this kind of emphasis on decentralized system building. And I think that, you know, I think that is something that I'm not sure if the powers that be, the elites, are aware that so many things are being built that are pro-humanity. Now, humans don't know it either. That's part of the problem, is like, you know, like, I'm the only one that's doing, you know, like, there's Bitcoiners, right? But nobody in my circle really knows that much about it. I've done 6 episodes, but that doesn't mean that, you know, my listeners fully understand the power of it. Same thing on the internet, a decentralized internet. I think that people are like, well, but Facebook is, I've just always done Facebook, or I've always used Google, right? And it's like this reliant on what has been an anti-humanity platform, no matter which way you want to slice it, the medical system, the healthcare, quote unquote, that makes everybody sick, the education system that dumbs all the kids down, the trust, it's a laziness on my tribe's part that we can't seem to say, look, I know it's convenient to rely on this system, but it's working against you and 7 generations in the future. So why don't we start thinking 7 generations in the future, build a money that works better for everybody, build a internet and a actual healthcare system that factors in health for future generations where children will be born, you know, instead of this, all this weird stuff where there's these, you know, eugenicists has really moved into full on, you know, into the health, quote unquote health. I always say quote unquote healthcare because it's a sham. It's meant to make people sick and get them dependent on pharmaceuticals. And we just did an episode about that, but I'm high on decentralized and it's moving so damn slow, right?
Yeah, it's tricky. The collapse of these old systems is inevitable in my experience and in my opinion.
Me too.
We are looking at that collapse, and I don't think there's a recovery of that, and I don't think it should be recovered. So when I look at what's going on with the education system, I don't think it's about saving the schools or saving the education system. That is on its way out. The healthcare system, same thing. It's on its way out.
Yeah.
So this, you know, a lot of this makes me think of Isaac Asimov's Foundation series.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever encountered that series?
Is that the, you know,
sci-fi writer?
Yeah. And,
right?
Yeah.
And so he writes about, you know, this character who, using this system called psychohistory,
mm-hmm.
is able to project using, you know, complex mathematics and predictive models, is able to project the arc of human history hundreds of thousands of years into the future. And in his projections, he sees the collapse of the galactic civilization that is existing currently, and the terrible suffering that is going to come from the collapse of this galactic civilization. And so he sets out on the path of seeking to build foundations that are going to soften the collapse. So his view is, it is inevitable. The collapse is coming. There's going to be great suffering. But if we start building the foundations now, then there is something to fall back upon. And, you know, I thought that was such a powerful metaphor for what we're really looking at today, that there is an inevitable collapse that is coming and inevitable forms of suffering, but that these decentralized systems are meant to soften that collapse. And this legacy keeper's mindset is meant to soften that collapse. That if we can generate legacies of knowledge and wisdom that are going to maintain their integrity from generation to generation, then there is a lot that can be saved and protected. Because it is my understanding that one of the greatest advantages we have is family legacy, is the capacity to generate stable family legacies over many generations. Because this is one of the few things that can survive the collapse of institutions. The family unit preserving wisdom and knowledge and moving it through the generations. The reason the family unit is under attack by this globalist group that is using communism as a weapon is precisely because family legacy threatens everything they are trying to do. The capacity for families to maintain legacies stable over the generations is a threat to them because it means there are human beings that are not reliant upon centralized systems of cultural production, of finance. It means that political cycles and the cycles of educational, you know, curricula, none of that can touch a stable family legacy that is maintained over the generations. This is one of the primary reasons that the family unit is under attack today. Yep. And so to me, if we're looking at building those foundations, it starts with family legacy, and then it moves into larger forms of legacy, which is, of course, legacies built by communities and organizations. You know, to an extent, it goes there, but it comes initially from that to me. And I think when we want to look from the micro to the macro, we need to first win the war on the family by stabilizing enough of our society that we can produce these legacies. And, you know, that in and of itself falls in line with this path of decentralization, of going from reliance on these big centralized systems to going back to reliance upon the family unit and evolving that. I think that's a very, very powerful path forward, much more powerful than people realize. And I just think it's helpful for people to understand that the centralized group of, you know, enemies that are intentionally seeking to destroy nation states so that power can be centralized on a global level are afraid of family legacy. It is an Achilles heel for them, and we should lean into it for that very reason.
Absolutely. You know, when you were talking about that, it reminded me when I was down at Charlie Kirk's America Fest in Phoenix in December, last December. I'm actually going to go this December as well. But, you know, they put all these young conservatives in the front, you know, and I remember Benny Johnson was on there and he was, you know, riffing, and he goes, you know, for all you young people out there, you know, this is a great place to find a conservative husband or wife. He goes, go get married, have too many kids, trust God, trust the whole process, like family's everything. I mean, there was such a pro-child, pro-innocence, you know, pro-humanity vibe there. And it was so different than, you know, I live in Seattle. It's a really woke area. You know, nobody's going to be, you know, shouting that stuff at any, you know, school board, you know, like everybody's just like really liberal and very leftist actually here. And I just found that message so reassuring. I'm a natural optimist. It created, you know, it kind of buoyed my optimism because there's all these young people that were there and they got their head screwed on right and they all want families and doesn't matter what the, you know, the liberal media is telling them, you know, it's going to be so hard. They're just like, no. I'm a conservative. I want family. I believe in family legacy. I believe in all these values. Yeah, it was fantastic. It really uplifted me. But I just wanted to thank you so much, Simon, for coming on Basecamp and sharing all your insight and your wisdom. You're just a really great person to talk to. Where can people find you and your work? And is there any other like creative projects that maybe we didn't touch on that you would like to point our listeners to?
Yeah, so you can go to simonessler.com to find my films and my work. There's lots there for you to explore. There is the Legacy Keepers project on there. You can get the questionnaire the Legacy Keepers questionnaire for free on my website if you're a parent that's looking to explore some of what I talked about today. You can find me on X. I'm actually really looking to grow my X right now. So you can find me on there, Simon Essler on X. I have a documentary project that I'm working on called Entrenched that looks into the evolution of warfare and the weaponization of human darkness. Mm. And I'm going to be offering some behind the scenes content and some things there for some subscribers on X. So that's a good place to help me grow. But I also have quite a big following on Instagram. That's where I've been able to somehow circumnavigate a lot of the censorship. So you can find me pretty active on Instagram as well. And I have a lot of things in the work right now. I'm currently editing for a nonprofit right now, doing some collaborations with Young Americans Against Socialism. I have some collaborations ongoing with Breakaway USA. So I have a lot going on, but I think it's important that people check out my sort of foundational works, which is my feature-length documentary, Cut, Daughters of the West, which was really born out of my understanding of the gender affirmative model and the societal changes that have deeply impacted, teen and preteen girls. And sort of looking at that from a broader perspective, that's designed to get people out of the political trenches when it comes to that issue. And you can also check out my series, Superorganism, which is a 6-part docuseries on the war on the family. And either one, if you view either of those films, you can also watch my short film collaboration with Adam Riva, which is a film called Vague Rules about the importation of communist ideology into the West through gender ideology, critical race theory, and COVID mandates. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot there, and I encourage people to check out my Substack as well. We got lots going there. You can find my Substack. You can find Simon Essler, and then you can also find a number of articles that I've published for Badlands Media. I've got some featured articles on their Substack and have explored some pretty deep topics over there. So lots to check out. And yeah, keep an eye out for my upcoming project, Entrenched. I'm going to go deep into some pretty crazy things. I mean, really into the struggle with this idea of Satanism and pedophilia and fifth generation warfare and how those things are actually really tied together.
When is that going to be out? Do you have a sense of,
I don't have a date. I would say, let's see.
Early 2025?
Probably spring.
Spring. Okay.
Yeah. We're looking at like a spring project. Cause I'm pretty sure I have all the interviews shot unless I add one more, but the interviews are shot and I'm mostly in a post-production phase now and really gathering all the research and tying it into what I discovered in the interviews. So, that's going to be an interesting piece for people. It's going to challenge a lot of what people believe about sort of the idea of satanic pedophilia on both sides, I think.
Yeah. Okay, great. Well, I can't wait to see it. We'll be tracking that. I follow you all over the place and just great job, on your writing and all the stuff that you're doing. So good luck with everything. Thanks for coming on Basecamp, Simon. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that conversation as much as I did. Man, we have a big election coming up, don't we? It feels as if almost anything can happen right now. Lots of people are waking up. Is it enough to move us positively into our next chapters, or do we need to go around and around the Marxist toilet bowl a few more years? God, I hope not. Personally, I can't handle seeing the American Republic so disrespected and dishonored by the leaders of the American corporation. There's a lot of chess pieces moving on the board right now. Devolution is lurking. Is the American corporation about to lose its life support? Let's keep alert, keep our collective cool while all this plays out. I'm in the narrative trenches with you, base campers. We'll have another fire next week, and we'll see you there. If you find value in our show and wish to show us some love, we are now making that very easy to do. You simply go to www.basecampformen.com and click on Donate Support Basecamp. You'll find an easy way to make either monthly donations for as little as $5 a month, or you can donate just once. We love the monthly donation and hope to build this up over the coming months, but any show of support is greatly appreciated, honestly. Thank you for your support and for helping to keep Basecamp as a resource on your hero's journey. That's our show for today. Thank you for listening. Men, good luck in all your endeavors and good luck on your hero's journey. This is Tony Rizak, and you're listening to Basecamp for Men.